This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On this Anzac Day, Australians flocked to the dawn service at Gallipoli despite security concerns in the lead up to the event. Hopes for a memorial park for the victims of the Bali bombing fade, with construction of a five-storey restaurant on the vacant site where the Sari Club once stood set to begin within a fortnight. And they're welcoming a long overdue visitor in southwestern Queensland. Saturating rain has come to a drought-struck country.
Yeah, it's getting a bit bleak. There's an ultralight here at the station, so I actually got to see it from the air. Ah, just an ocean of water. That's certainly an impressive sight, that one.
Turkish authorities say they've arrested a 25-year-old man who was planning an attack on the Anzac service at Gallipoli. Authorities have told the ABC that he was preparing bombs in retaliation for the Christchurch mosque killings last month. The service was already under a cloud when the Turkish president recently suggested that any anti-Muslim visitors would be sent back in coffins. Yet despite this, operators say Australians have turned out for the dawn service. Eleanor Whitehead has more.
Tensions ahead of today's Gallipoli commemorations have been rising for weeks, but Australian pilgrims have still flocked to Anzac Cove.
It's certainly one of those bucket list things to do for a lot of people, especially those who have a connection.
Dennis Basham is global head of sales for On The Go Tours. He says its clients are unfazed by threatening comments from Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
From our point of view, it didn't affect our business. We were interested to see whether we were going to then get requests for cancellations to see if anyone had decided not to go, but we haven't received that either.
In a speech after the Christchurch massacre, the Turkish president said visitors who expressed anti-Muslim views would be sent home in coffins like their Anzac grandfathers, but later claimed his words had been taken out of context. Historian Matt McLaughlin has been running tours to Gallipoli for years and says the relationship between Anzac pilgrims and local residents is still strong.
The sense you get when you come to Gallipoli is the shared experience with the local Turkish people. And so it's a world away from politicians making grand statements.
About 1,500 Australians and New Zealanders are expected to attend the dawn service in Anzac Cove. That's despite heightened concerns for security. The Turkish government has banned locals from attending and only registered foreigners will be allowed in. But Matt McLaughlin says nothing else has changed.
The security is like it is every year here. It's very, very tight. The sites are fenced off, there's metal detectors, and there are police and military personnel fully armed everywhere you look. This is always going to be a very heavily policed event, and nothing is different this year.
The number of pilgrims travelling to Gallipoli for Anzac Day has declined following an attempted coup in Turkey in 2016 and a series of terrorist incidents. But he believes visitors' confidence is rising again.
Travel warnings were relaxed at the end of last year, so we haven't seen a big surge of people coming back to Gallipoli, but I'm fairly confident that in the coming years we'll see more and more people wanting to come here. It's just such an iconic destination.
Executive Director of the Australia Defence Association, Neil James, takes a more cautious view. He says Australians may not always be able to take their Anzac commemorations for granted under an increasingly autocratic Turkish government.
It's the Islamist nationalists who are now running the show. And I can actually foresee a time where we wouldn't have major ceremonies at Gallipoli anymore, because it just wouldn't be possible culturally and politically in Turkey. Every Australian going there needs to, be quite tactful and diplomatic and thankful and realise that the Turkey they're visiting is different to the Turkey they visited 10 or 12 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It's a completely different country to what it was only a very short time ago.
And that's the Australia Defence Association's Neil James ending that report from Eleanor Whitehead. This year's Anzac Day commemorations do come during a fractious period in Australia's relationship with Turkey. A new documentary made by a Turkish filmmaker backs that up. It shows a degree of resentment among the Turkish people towards Australians visiting Gallipoli. But the filmmaker says he's frustrated the Australian War Memorial, which brought the film movie last year, is yet to screen it. Evan Morgan Graham reports.
The trailer to Turkish video artist Kokan Ogun's film Heroes features this song about a Turkish mother preparing her son for war. The accompanying video shows modern-day Turkish women weeping while watching a reenactment of young soldiers in battle.
I was using this art project as a tool to educate myself and to say, Kökan, go and find out why are people so patriotic? Why are people blindly nationalistic?
Kökan Ergun's work looks at patriotism on both sides, Turkish and Australian. It features vision of Kentucky tour buses and young Australians wearing Anzac Day merchandise. It also includes shots of an Anzac guest book with slurs against visiting Australians written in Turkish. Some of them read,
"You came here, but your return was disastrous.
You're in my country now. Behave.
Don't ever think of invading us again.
You can't go around half naked among martyrs. Have some respect.
F***ing infidels."
Kökan Ergun says he was given assurances the Australian War Memorial would screen his film, and even recalls one of its directors giving him emphatic praise.
"We did a screening in Canberra, but not in the War Memorial, in a separate space. And then he came up to me, this director. He said he loved the film. I said, you sure you really love it? He said, yes, I think this is a very important work for our collection."
But a year after the film was released, and despite co-commissioning it, Kökan Ergun is frustrated the War Memorial is yet to screen it.
"Maybe they're talking and then the art department wants to do it, but the other department don't want to do it. I don't know."
In a statement, the Australian War Memorial said the film was screened at ArtSpace Sydney last May in conjunction with the memorial. But with more than 38,000 artworks in its collection, it isn't always able to display them straight away. Michael McKenna is a history professor at the University of Sydney and argues it's healthy for Australia to question stories linked to national identity.
"Anzac Day is the primary national myth that Australia has to understand itself at the moment, and that has been one that's been encouraged, so much so that it's become almost sacrosanct."
But Professor McKenna believes the film is particularly pertinent, given the Turkish government's attempts to stir up nationalism.
"If you go to Turkey, you'll see the way in which the government over the last decade or so has tried to cast the defence of Turkey through Gallipoli as a kind of victory for Islamic Turkey. I think it's crucial that the War Memorial shows that film, because that film, as we know, is one which is open to critical interpretations of the legend on both sides, you know, on the Turkish side and on the Australian side."
And that's Sydney University Professor Michael McKenna ending Evan Morgan Graham's report. More than 100 years since Anzac bonds were first forged at Gallipoli, there is a fresh push to allow New Zealanders to join the Australian Defence Force. But defence documents obtained by AM reveal broader government concern about so-called insider threat is one reason why the ADF is preventing young Kiwis from serving. Here's defence correspondent Andrew Green.
Hundreds of thousands of New Zealanders call Australia home, but for many there's virtually no chance they'll ever be granted citizenship. A welfare crackdown introduced by the Howard government in 2001 means Kiwi arrivals are non-protected special visa holders ineligible for most social security benefits. And as non-citizens, it means they're blocked from the Defence Force.
"It is time things changed."
Kevin Bovell served in both the New Zealand and Australian armies, with deployments to Vietnam and Borneo. He's among a group of veterans from both sides of the Tasman who've argued unsuccessfully for years for special exemptions that would allow young Kiwis to enlist in Australia even if they're not citizens.
"The Australian government and defence recruiting turn around, say, bugger off, you want to join the army, go to New Zealand. They place absolutely no value on the loyalty and commitment expressed by these young kids who are endeavouring to make a career in the ADF."
Now, internal Defence Department correspondence obtained by AM offers some insights into why. In an email sent last year, the head of Defence Recruiting wrote,
"The process and mechanisms for obtaining security clearances are now heavily reliant on an applicant holding Australian citizenship."
Adding,
"Citizenship remains a key criteria to enter the ADF, and permanent residents will only ever be forwarded to the services for a waiver decision when there are no other candidates with Australian citizenship."
In a reply, the head of the government's security vetting agency explains that given the wider government focus on mitigating the insider threat, all existing applications from non-Australian citizens have been withdrawn. 18-year-old Sarah is one Anzac hopeful who's been affected.
I went through and did a lot of my testing, thought I was all good on that, thought I had my second assessment day booked. And a couple of weeks out from that, I got a call, pretty vague call, saying regulations changed. We're withdrawing the application, don't want to hear from you until you've been granted your citizenship.
Despite the setbacks, the young woman who's lived in Australia for 11 years says she's not giving up on one day serving her adopted country.
Definitely. I'm not going to let that dream go. I'm hoping as soon as I can get citizenship through, then I'll be there in my greens and serving my country.
And that's aspiring ADF recruit Sarah, ending that report by our defence correspondent Andrew Green. Today is an occasion to reflect on past conflicts, the hundreds of lives lost and the treasure sacrificed over the generations. But what about the future? How will those wars be won and lost? And is there enough effort put into avoiding them in the first place? I was joined earlier by Peter Layton, a visiting fellow at the Griffith Asia Institute at Griffith University and a retired RAAF group captain. Pillation, is enough money and, for that matter, willpower being spent to avoid conflict in the first place, given that in many cases war is the ultimate failure of diplomacy?
Well, I suppose there's a fair bit of money being spent in diplomacy at the present time. It is better off, as you say, always to talk rather than make war. One of the oldest axioms, I suppose, of the defence profession is that if you wish to avoid war, be well prepared so that you deter conflict rather than have to fight it.
Big data, the Internet of Things, 3D printing, you think that these could all radically change the way that Australian forces are equipped and fight future wars. How?
Well, we have to sort of step back a fraction and look at the fourth industrial revolution there, that gad bag of technologies. Basically means that we can design, build and use e-equipment on a much faster cycle so that we can design, build and when we're using it, there's a positive feedback loop and the information about our experiences of using it is fed back into the design part. Now that sets up a positive feedback loop with me there, and that means that gives military forces three big advantages. One is that you can use prototype warfare. That is that you can design, build and use specialised air equipment for a single tactical battle, let's say. So rather than buying something for, say, 30 years.
On air equipment, what are you talking about?
For prototype warfare there, so that you can build some equipment and build it for a particular battle. So that rather than having some equipment, let's say, being in service for 30 years, instead you will optimise your equipment for the particular war you are fighting right now.
Can you give us an example?
Let's say that you were going into a conflict situation in the desert. You could optimise your ground vehicles, and in the future, of course, driverless ground vehicles, robot ground vehicles, you could optimise those working in the desert rather than, say, optimising them for working in the tropics. At the present time, we tend to buy military hardware which is useful across a wide range of environments. But with a fourth industrial revolution, you could optimise it just for the environment you are currently fighting in.
All right. You think that 3D printing too could radically change things. How?
Well, that's one example there. The second is that you could now mobilise defence. At the present time, it takes a long time to build military hardware. But with 3D printing, you can keep the plans literally on the software shelf and at the appropriate time, use the plans to drive a 3D printer and produce the spare parts and the maintenance items that you need. And not just that, but you could also do that with a unit deployed in the field or a squadron at a distant airbase or a ship at sea. You simply send them the software and they can print out the spare parts themselves.
How is Australia adapting to this scenario? And I guess in considering that, is it wise to be building things like 12 big new submarines? Will they be obsolete?
That's an excellent question because at the moment the technology being used in defence is changing very rapidly. The theory at least goes at the present time is that you'll have a small number of expensive large platforms and they will operate, if you like, a swarm of the robots. And these swarm of robots might be produced by 3D printers. For example, they're talking about one 3D printer being able to make 100 drones, that is small drone aircraft, a day. And if you have 100 3D printers, you can produce 10,000 drones a day. So the idea is to have, as I said, sort of have a combination force structure. If if you like, to have a mix of complicated long-life items, but also to produce robot swarms using 3D printers, optimised for the situation that you find yourself in.
Given that picture then, is it naive to hope perhaps that conflicts costing thousands of lives are a thing of the past?
One would like to think that you'll end up in a situation, I suppose, of robots fighting robots. But then that sort of gets down to a question of, I suppose, to ask the bad question or the dreadful question is that war, if you have a machine fighting a machine, it turns into a sort of an industrial conflict then where sort of your machines beat their machines. If people are willing to accept the outcome of such a battle, then that would certainly lower the number of casualties. The question is after the machines have done their fighting, will human beings accept the outcome?
And that's Peter Layton, a visiting fellow at the Griffith Asia Institute and a retired RAAF group captain. Sri Lanka's government is promising it will find and punish anyone linked to an Islamist group believed to be responsible for the Easter Sunday bombings. But as politicians and officials blame each other for the tragedy, it's becoming clear just how obvious the danger was. Not only did authorities know the group was gathering explosives, they ignored warnings from the country's Muslim leaders about radical elements within their community. From Colombo, Eric Torchik reports.
A few days ago, Sri Lanka's Christians fled Islamist terror attacks. Now, Muslims in one part of the country are fleeing reprisals.
From last night, they are trying to attack them and break their houses, and they are throwing away from there, saying, go away from this area, something like that.
Muslim refugees from Pakistan have been living in Negombo, where one of the deadliest church bombings occurred. Refugee Farah Jamil says they've now been chased out by angry locals. They're hitting us, she says. Even our landlord is not letting us live here. She's saying to get out of here and go wherever you want to go, but don't live here. About 10% of Sri Lanka's population is Muslim. Community leaders say they warned authorities about an extremist cleric who's believed to have planned the Easter Sunday attacks. Government Minister Rauf Hakim is the leader of the Sri Lanka Muslim Congress, the largest Islamic political party.
As late as January this year, the Council of Theologians of the Muslim community had made an official complaint to the police that this radical, self-appointed, so-called Muslim cleric should be apprehended and his activity should be looked into thoroughly.
But Mr. Hakim says no one expected violence on the scale of the bombings.
Of course, we have been somewhat complacent because we should have followed it up much more seriously. But nobody would ever even dare think that a Sri Lankan Muslim could turn into such a murderous, dangerous extremist who could go to this extent and do such dastardly things.
The warning signs were glaring. Police had found a cache of explosives in January when they arrested members of an Islamist group in the country's northwest. However, Sri Lanka's security services did not act earlier this month when they received warning of an imminent threat of suicide bombings in Catholic churches. That failure has led the country's president to sack the defence secretary and chief police inspector. Now, both Christians and Muslims are afraid. In the Colombo street where two of the bombers lived, neighbours like Taiba Razak are worried there'll be more violence.
All the kids in the lane, everybody is scared. My small brother is even not going to bathroom alone. He was not like that. If no one is having a proper sleep, not a proper meal, everybody is like thinking what will happen the next moment. Even when I sleep in the night also, I think, don't know whether I will get up the next morning.
And that's Muslim Sri Lankan Taiba Razak ending that report by Eric Torchik in Colombo. For more than a decade, survivors of the Bali bombings have been fighting for the establishment of a peace park on the vacant site where the Sari Club once stood. Various governments have pledged hundreds of thousands of dollars and several prime ministers have pressed the issue with Indonesian officials. But the dream appears to be slipping away, with construction of a five-storey restaurant set to begin within a fortnight. Indonesia correspondent David Lipson filed this report from Kuta.
In the corner of a dusty open car park in Kuta, the owner of a makeshift local kiosk is deep-frying chicken for lunch. Komaria's been doing this every day for 5 years, but now she's getting ready to shut up shop for good. The owner of the land wants to build here, she tells us. They told me to get out by May 5. Everything must be cleared out by then. Her kiosk stands on no ordinary vacant lot. It's here the Sari Club used to stand, a lively Kuta night spot, before it was blown up by a car bomb in 2002, on a night when 88 Australians lost their lives. Ever since, a group of survivors and families have dreamt of turning the site into a peace park, a spot for quiet reflection amid the throng of Kuta's main strip. Now that dream is slipping through their fingers.
We can't let that happen. We definitely can't let that happen.
Gary Nash from Cardup, WA, survived horrific burns and injuries when a suicide bomber blew up the nearby Paddy's Bar. He's shocked at plans to develop the site into a five-storey, 350-seat restaurant.
That's an insult to everybody. Not only the Australians were killed there, but everybody in the world, all the other nations that had people killed there, it's just an insult to them.
Over 11 years, the Bali Peace Park Association has raised close to $1 million for the project. And according to the chairman, David Napoli, were given clear and ongoing assurances from the governor the site would never be used for commercial development.
They were actually very clear for many, many years in stating that no commercial building would be put on that property. It was reserved for a peace park or a memorial park.
A new governor was elected last June. By December, a building permit had been issued. Since then, there's been some discussion of a memorial of sorts on the fifth floor, but even the locals are suspicious. Agung from the Kuta Institute for Community Empowerment says residents have been given very little information. A historical event occurred there that hurt us Balinese and Indonesians, he tells us, and we can't just forget that. Construction is set to begin on the 9th of May, but last-ditch efforts are underway to try to stop the developers. David Napoli knows time is running out.
Once construction begins, of course, I think we've lost any hope of achieving our goal of building a memorial park for those victims killed.
And that's Bali Peace Park Chairman David Napoli ending that report from David Lipson. Scientists at the CSIRO are trying to work out exactly what species of blue-green algae caused the mass fish kill in outback New South Wales this summer. Water samples from the site are now under the microscope, 1,500 kilometres away at the National Algae Culture Collection in Hobart. Felicity Ogilvie reports.
This is the most disgusting thing I've ever seen in my life.
Standing knee-deep in the toxic Darling River near Menindee back in January and surrounded by dead fish, farmers Rob McBride and Dick Arnold couldn't believe their eyes.
Makes me feel like crying again.
1,500 kilometres away in Hobart, CSIRO algae expert Dr Anasuya Willis knew she had to act.
I contacted some colleagues at Water New South Wales and asked them that during their general usual monitoring of the system, they could send me a sample from where the bloom was greatest. And at that time it was in Lake Menindee.
It arrived at the Australian National Algae Culture Collection by express post within days. The centre holds hundreds of algae samples from around the world, but focuses on Australian species, including a number from previous blooms in the very same river.
You can see how thick and green they are now.
Yeah, they're coming up really well. They've got that classic blue-green colour, don't they?
Yeah, there's even a little bit of scum forming along the top.
Under the microscope, Dr Willis sees an algae that is different to the blooms prevalent in the Murray-Darling back in the 1990s.
So the water, it looked like just water from the environment, slightly greenish tinge. When I looked under the microscope, I saw lots of different species of green algae.
Blue-green algae can be toxic to humans, causing liver and nerve damage if people drink contaminated water. But in the Darling River, it killed the fish indirectly. When the massive bloom of algae died, bacteria fed on it, taking oxygen out of the water and suffocating the fish.
To look at them, they're very difficult to tell apart, but molecularly, their genetics can be quite different. And one of the important differences is that they can have different toxins.
The director of the National Algae Collection, Ian Jameson, says it's important not only to identify the species of algae that killed the fish, but also what was happening in the river at the time.
So all of these algae respond to different environmental cues, and we really need to know what those cues are, and the physiology of the algae themselves is the only way that we can factor that into proper management of the systems themselves. If we don't know what the causative organisms are and how they respond to the environment, then it makes it far more difficult to actually put in potential control measures.
The scientists have grown 30 different cultures of this summer's blue-green algal bloom in the lab. Dr. Willis is ready to send algae samples to other researchers around the country who are also studying the massive fish kill event.
So the more we know about the algae, the more we can manage the blooms and predict the blooms. So if we know we have an algae that is highly toxic, then we can manage for a highly toxic water system. Whereas if we have a bloom that is less toxic, then we are managing for different things, like the fish kills when the blooms are really large. And then perhaps we can do something to prevent them happening and getting to the extent that they were this year.
The CSIRO scientists hope to have their research into the algae finished in the next few months.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting. Graziers in drought-ridden southwestern Queensland are all smiles today at the best rain they've seen in about 8 years. Some places have received more than 100 millimetres in recent days, but just 60 millimetres on some cattle stations will take the pressure off for the next few months. It's even meant the cancellation of the traditional Anzac Day meet in the town of Cunnamulla today, as Isabel Rowe reports.
Well, this used to be a road.
2 days ago, Tim Roberts' quad bike kicked up dust. Now the roads are rivers and the bike is covered in mud.
I've just been out riding around today and making a bit of a mess. No, the country's definitely really saturated. This is definitely the best rain we've had in a long time. Don't know if our charts go back that far.
His family property is south of Mitchell in cattle country, more than 600 kilometres inland from Brisbane. The local council area has been drought declared for 6 years. But in the last 48 hours, a rain system has soaked cattle stations in some of the driest parts of southwest Queensland. The biggest falls have dumped more than 100 millimetres in rain gauges. While the rain hasn't reached Queensland's far western border, water from last month's ex-tropical cyclone Trevor has made its way downstream. Third-generation farmer Patrick Tully took to the skies above his property near Baduri on the Queensland Northern Territory border.
Yeah, it's getting a bit bleak. We were doing all right, really, because we've been pretty light on stock for 3 or 4 years now. But yeah, we were thinking about having to get rid of it. We got rid of 300 cows last year, just had to take them off the station. And we were thinking about might we have to do another kind of similar thing again at the start of this year before the storms and the floods and stuff. There's an ultralight here at the station, so I actually got to see it from the air. Ah, just an ocean of water. That's certainly an impressive sight, that one.
Graziers are hesitant to call it drought-breaking, but Tim Roberts says the last 48 hours has ensured his cattle will get through the next few months.
I suppose leading into winter is always a pretty stressful time there if you don't have much grass, but no, this will be a huge help, actually. It's really taken a lot of pressure off everyone anyway.
In Cunnamulla, near Queensland's southern border, graziers are thankful for 60 millimetres.
We haven't seen falls in Cunnamulla that much in one hit since 2012.
That was the year Kathleen Fagan swapped city life in Brisbane to teach at a school in Cunnamulla, while her husband spends his days pushing over trees with a tractor to feed cattle.
There's no break. He doesn't get a sick day. If we don't feed, then our cattle die and that's our livelihood that's gone. It mounts up and it becomes a significant mental health issue. If it's not for our friends and our family, it's a huge, huge impact on what that does to the brain and what it does to your lifestyle and your attitude.
But yesterday, as the rain kept coming, Kathleen saw her husband do something he hadn't done in a long time.
We sat on the veranda and it was great to see him smile, like really, really smile. Not smile because someone made a funny joke or smile because he watched some silly YouTube video, but smile with just this this joy and appreciation of what we've been blessed with.
How good's that? Teacher and grazier Kathleen Fagan ending Isabel Rowe's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hello there, PK and Fran here from the party room.
Are you a little confused about this water buyback story? Let's face it, who isn't?
If you want the inside scoop on that interview with Barnaby Joyce, if you're just tuning in, this is RN Drive and we are broadcasting across the Asia Pacific. Barnaby Joyce is our guest.
The Labor Party were the first people.
If you haven't heard it, you better. We've made a bonus episode of The Party Room for you. It's in your feed now.
Search for The Party Room wherever you get your podcasts or find us on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.